Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for being here today. This lecture is on a series of watercolor painted sepia photographs that Italian artist Luigi Ontani realized in India in collaboration with local photographers and colorists in the second half of the 70s. I am currently writing my dissertation on Ontani's work in the 70s at the Graduate Center CUNY. Now I'd like to ask you to please silence your phones and feel free to ask me questions at the end of my lecture. First, I'd like to spend a moment to introduce Ontani's work prior to his first trip to India. Ontani was born in 1943 into a working-class family from a small town called Vergato in the mountains near Bologna. He is a self-taught artist who started exhibiting in the late 60s. Here are some of Ontani's first artistic experiments. On the right, he is posing for the camera, holding a work which consists of a palette on which paint has been substituted by ID-type portraits of people with the names of colors, such as Rose, picked from the phone book. Ontani moved to Rome in the early 70s and soon established himself as a maverick in the landscape of Italian art. Ontani's tenaciously independent attitude has contributed to his difficult reception in this country, despite several solo exhibitions at prestigious New York venues since 1977, and most recently a retrospective at MoMA PS1 Contemporary Art Center in 2001. Around 1970, Ontani started to pose as figures from old master paintings in color photographs that he called d'après, or quadri non quadri, paintings non paintings. On the left is one of the first works of this kind entitled San Sebastiano nel Bosco di Calvenzano, d'après Guido Reni, Saint Sebastian in the Woods of Calvenzano, after Guido Reni. On the right is the Baroque painting by Reni that inspired Ontani and is in the collection of the Pinacoteca Nazionale in Bologna. As you can see, Ontani reinterpreted rather than replicated Reni's figure. Ontani conceived his d'après to be compelling in size in order to mimic the grand size of altarpieces. He usually printed two formats, 27 by 40 inches and life size, which was quite a technical achievement at the time. And to mimic painting, as a rule, he made unique prints. This one is 27 by 40 and is in the collection of Fabio Sargentini in Rome. In Christian iconography, Saint Sebastian is the figure that more than any other has been associated with homoeroticism. As literature historian Richard Kay put it, Saint Sebastian is, quote, the single most successfully deployed image of modern male gay identity, unquote. And indeed, Saint Sebastian is a subject with whom Ontani identified early on as, quote, a simulacrum of ambiguity, unquote, the ambiguity of androgynous beauty, as in a male youth, and the ambiguity of art, as he explained. Thus, this work can be seen as a self-portrait on different levels, including in association with Reni, who was born in Calvenzano, a hamlet of Ontani's hometown. At times, Ontani transmogrified his sources according to his own dandy or camp sensibility, as in this early diptych from around 1970, here on top, after Goya's clothed Maya and nude Maya from around 1800, which you see right below. Most helpful in understanding Ontani's dandy or camp sensibility, which is a central aspect of his approach to art and life, is a mid-60s essay by American Susan Sontag. Sontag defines camp as, quote, dandism in the age of mass culture, unquote. And she explains, quote, camp sees everything in quotation marks. To perceive camp in objects and persons is to understand being as playing a role. It is the farthest extension in sensibility of the metaphor of life as theater. Unquote. This diptych was included in Ontani's first major group exhibition in 1974, which traveled from Switzerland to Germany to Austria, and was dedicated to the theme of transvestism with artists and rock stars like Urs Luti, Andy Warhol, and David Bowie. Ontani soon expanded his subjects to include types and characters, from history, literature, opera, folklore, and the mass media. On top left is Nazista Nazi from 1974. This is one of Ontani's difficult to translate titles, as it is a punning neologism that plays with the alliteration in Italian between Nazi and Nazi, which means noses, and with the double use of sta, S-T-A, as part of the word Nazi, or as a word in its own right. So in English it would be something like Nazi noses or Nazi stays noses. Because of time constraints, I will not always be able to explain Ontani's difficult to translate title, so if I don't offer translation, that's why. 1974 was also the year when Ontani started to stage tableaux vivants that rendered the ludic mise-en-scene of the photographs more tangible. Here are Tarzan at the bottom and Pulcinella on top from 1974, both of them. Tarzan was included in Contemporanea, a large group show curated by Achille Bonito Oliva in the underground parking lot of Villa Borghese in Rome. Pulcinella, instead, was staged at the prominent gallery of Lucio Amelio in Naples. Pulcinella is the Neapolitan stock character of the Commedia dell'arte, which is an Italian age-old tradition of folk theater. Ontani impersonated Pulcinella wearing nothing but the character's trademark conical white hat and black half-face mask. These are the last works prior to Ontani's first Indian trips that I'm showing you. On the left is a slide projection of Ontani posing as the angel of the Annunciation. His pose references the iconography of the Annunciation rather than any specific painting. This slide projection was the first work visitors encountered upon entering Ontani's first major solo show at L'Attico of Fabio Sargentini in Rome in 1974. L'Attico was the most advanced gallery in town since the mid-60s. It hosted radical shows like Yannis Kounalis's 1969 installation of Live Horses, and it became Ontani's representing gallery. On the right is a photograph taken by artist Gwen Thomas of Ontani's tableau vivant as Christopher Columbus, in front of the Columbus Circle Memorial in New York City in the fall 1975. Ontani flew to New York with Sargentini dressed as Christopher Columbus. The costume was rented from a prominent costume designer for the theater and cinema named Umberto Tirelli. What all these works have in common is an economy of means and an attitude of detachment and self-irony on the part of the artist. These characteristics are also shared with the works in the Indian series. Ontani started to embrace appropriation strategies tied into an exploration of the permutability of identity in performance and photography several years before they became the main tenet of an international postmodern trend in the visual arts, as in the work of Cindy Sherman. For this reason, he ought to be considered a pioneering figure. Sargentini was a key figure in stimulating a renewed interest for India in Rome in the early 70s. He traveled to India in 1972, and the following year he organized a tantric art show and raga concerts with Indian musicians at his gallery. On the left is an image from one of these concerts. Actually, two of the musicians from the left are Americans Lamonte Young and Terry Riley, who studied Indian music. India had been a favorite destination for beat and hippie counterculture internationally since Allen Ginsberg's first travels to India in the early 60s. And even before and beyond that, India had fascinated many Italian intellectuals and film directors, from Roberto Rossellini to Alberto Moravia and Pierpaolo Pasolini, to name the most famous, who traveled to India in the 50s and 60s, filmed documentaries for the TV, and wrote reportage for daily newspapers that were published in book form. Ontani left on his first trip to India in the winter of 1974-75. For Ontani, India first represented the projection of an exotic desire, mature during the artist's adolescence, reading novels by authors such as Alberto Savinio and Giovanni Commisso, on exciting travels and transgressions that stimulated his imagination, as did the late 19th century Orientalist castle in Moorish Revival style, with its fantastically decorated period rooms, known as the Rocchetta Mattei, located near Ontani's birth town. On the right here is a bird's eye view of the castle. But then, Ontani's first trip was far from any dream of exotic travel. It was a long, solitary, and extreme trip that he described as a sort of heroic undertaking, in which he put himself through existential tests in search of a total loss of bearings. By the end of the trip, he had shed many pounds, and his original return ticket had long expired. However, he had begun what was to become a large, open-ended series of sepia-toned photographs painted in watercolor. Ontani titled the series En route vers l'Inde d'après Pierre Loti, On the Way to India After Pierre Loti, in homage to Pierre Loti. En route vers l'Inde is the title of the first chapter of a 1903 book Loti wrote on his travels through India entitled L'Inde sans les Anglais, in English translation, India. Loti was a French naval officer, a novelist, a dandy, and one of the greatest figures of fin de siècle exoticism. On the left is the installation photograph of the series at the Venice Biennale of 1978, courtesy of Giorgio Colombo. The series was first presented earlier that year at Latico, for the first time. On the right is the series exhibited at the Guggenheim Museum in New York in 1982 as part of the group show Italian Art Now. The series is at present comprised of over 100 works, some of which are prints from the same negative, overpainted differently, or different poses of the same subject. This lecture concentrates on the works realized in the second half of the 70s, but the series continued to be expanded again from the early 90s onward, although at an ever slower pace, partly due to the increasing difficulty in finding photo colorists. In terms of size, as you can see, the photos range from life-size to miniature. The largest work at the bottom center of these displays measures 40 by 55 inches. In terms of composition, they feature Ontani always posing alone or with animals, either in the studio or outdoors, and sometimes they incorporate montage, which at the time, of course, was manual. Notice the dynamic hanging of these displays, reminiscent of the experiments of the international avant-garde, with works hung above, at, and below eye level, and two works touching the floor. Over the course of the past 30 years, the series has been exhibited in this collage-like hanging style, although in different combinations, interspersed with always new pieces. And in India, it was first exhibited in 1991 at the Indian Triennial in Delhi. On the left is one of the first works in the series and one that is still unpublished. It bears the same title of the series like other works. It depicts Ontani dressed in everyday local clothes, floating above a comparatively gigantic copy of the book by Loti that he brought with himself on his first trip, and on the cover of which he had glued a reproduction of Henri Rousseau's portrait of Loti. Notice how Ontani referenced the pose of Loti's right arm and hand in Rousseau's painting. This work speaks to Loti being a quote-unquote literary alibi for Ontani, as he put it. On the right is a photo of Loti, dressed in an Arab robe brought back from one of his trips to Palestine. Loti's novels from the late 19th to the early 20th century represent the first considerable attempt in Western literature to deal with male homoeroticism. One of the most remarkable aspects of Ontani's series is that it combines the different mediums of performance, photography, and painting. Ontani's interest in breaking down the boundaries between these mediums, already evident in his earlier work, found a fertile ground in India in the vernacular tradition of hand-painted photography, which was still thriving in the 70s and became obsolete in the early 80s, when color photography became cheaper than hand-tinting. Ontani collaborated with photo studios in Jaipur, Delhi, Varanasi, and Madras. Most of the works discussed in this presentation were executed in collaboration with Studio Rajendra in Jaipur, a small studio located in a narrow back street of the busy Johari Bazaar. Although generally, Ontani exercised a certain degree of control in the enactment of the poses and the tinting process, he always allowed chance to play a role because for him, art is like life, an adventure. Ontani's choice of collaborating with local craftspeople had an important precedent in the work of Italian artist Alighiero Boetti, who began commissioning carpets with world maps and square scripts from Afghan women embroiderers in Kabul in 1971. On the left is one of Boedi's first maps. Another Italian artist who followed Boedi's example was Francesco Clemente, who started collaborating with Indian sign painters around 1976. On the right is one of the miniature paintings in a series that Clemente executed in 1980-81, in collaboration with a Jaipur workshop that produced copies and versions of Mughal and Rajput miniatures for the tourist market. Boetti, Ontani, and Clemente were all based in Rome since the early 70s. And like Ontani, Clemente went to India several times in the course of the 70s, and in 1977 they went together as part of a traveling exhibition organized by Sargentini. I'd like to open a parenthesis here to draw your attention to an important point regarding Ontani's work in the context of 1970s Italian art. Ontani has always been an independent artist. While Boetti and Clemente were associated with the two main movements of post-war Italian art, Boetti was associated with Arte Povera, which was at its height in the late 60s, and Clemente with Transavanguardia, which was launched in 1979. In the prevailing art historical narrative, the 70s are overshadowed by the dialectical sequence of these two movements, with Arte Povera being characterized by the use of unconventional, everyday materials in works that call for direct and mediated experience, and Transavanguardia being associated with the recuperation of traditional artistic mediums and appropriation of art historical styles and subjects. These characteristics of Transavanguardia have been used to define it as a postmodern reaction to Arte Povera. However, a study of Ontani's 70s work calls this dialectical model into question, as it reveals that a postmodern sensibility clearly emerged earlier in Italian art and not as a challenge of a previous movement or trend, but within the fertile context of Italian culture's peculiar integration of the past into the present, and as a survival strategy at the onset of the darkest period in Italian post-war history, commonly remembered as the Anni di Piombo, or Years of Lead. Ontani said that when he left for India, he was looking for a place that would be, quote-unquote, most definitely other from his country of origin. Between 1969 and 1980, extreme right and left-wing terrorism devastated the country, and further aggravating this extremely troubled socio-political situation, the 1973 oil crisis inaugurated a decade of recession unprecedented since World War II. On the left is a photo of one of the workers' strikes, that took over the squares of the main Italian cities in the fall 1969. This was the peak of the 1968 protest movement, and on the right is the aftermath of the first of a number of deadly explosions plotted by neo-fascist groups to counter this. On Ontani's work and its narcissistic subtext, in relation to the country's heated socio-political times, I'd like to quote Nicholas Cullinan, curator at the Tate Modern in London, who wrote, quote, "By embracing desire, pleasure, and sensuality, Ontani's dandyism was diametrically opposed to the dour seriousness of a failing left wing. Desire has always occupied an uneasy place in contemporary Italian art, perhaps problematized by the conflicting but equally restrictive twin influences of communism and Catholicism," unquote. Ontani posed several times as San Sebastian in India, as in the works on the left and middle from around 1976. These are much smaller than Ontani's earlier San Sebastians after Guido Reni. They are 13 by 12 and 16 by 13 inches. Rather than old masters, these works reference kitsch, commercially produced, and small religious images that in Italian are called santini, like the one on the right in the collection of the artist. Such self-conscious use of kitsch is a characteristic of camp, as Susan Sontag observed. Ontani titled the work on the left simply San Sebastiano Indiano, in San Sebastian, and the work in the middle San Sebastiano Jaipurano, which is one of his difficult-to-translate titles as it contains a wordplay. Ano, or A-N-O, in Jaipurano, is both the suffix that indicates provenance, so the title translates as San Sebastian from Jaipur, and it is also the word ano, or anus, hence the reference to homosexual pleasure, the Orientalist trope of licentiousness, and the conflation of the sacred and the profane. indeed a distinguishing mark of Indian art and one that must have conquered Antani's imagination is, quote, the coexistence of the sacred with the secular, the profane or the sensuous, unquote, to borrow the words of Indian art scholar Vidya Dehesia. Here I'm showing you almost a collage of Saint Sebastian's to give you an idea of the pervasiveness of the subject in gay culture. Counterclockwise from top left, Italian pictorialist photographer Federico Maria Poppi with Martirio di San Sebastiano, Martyrdom of Saint Sebastian from around 1900. Right below is a frame from the music video Losing My Religion by the American rock band R.E.M. from 1991. Next to it is a frame from the 1976 film Sebastiane by British film director Derek Jarman. The title is a Latin vocative, and Latin is the language of the film, which caused quite a stir for its overt depiction of homosexual desire. Finally, on top right is Japanese writer Yukio Mishima posing as San Sebastian in 1966, a few years before his 1970 ritual suicide by seppuku, or self-disembowelment. Mishima is one of Antani's favorite writers and the author of a 1949 novel entitled Confessions of a Mask, in which the encounter with the reproduction of Guido Reni's San Sebastian prompts the homosexual self-awakening of the protagonist. Four main groups of subjects can be identified in En route vers l'Inde. One, figures from 16th, 20th century paintings. Two, historical or imaginary Maharajas. Three, typical or common contemporary Indians, and four, Hindu deities. The work on the left is one of the few literal poses from paintings in the series, entitled Autoritratto nudo da pre Chirico, Nude Self-Portrait after De Chirico, from 1978. The source is on the right and is a late self-portrait by the founder of metaphysical painting, who represented himself seated and loin-clad like a Christian martyr. It is an unusual self-portrait from around 1945 in the collection of the Galleria Nazionale d'Arte Moderna in Rome. Iconographically references the traditional representation of Christ seated and crowned with thorns, which here is an allusion to human vulnerability. Now I'd like to take you on a little detour into Italian art prior to the 70s in order to underline the idiosyncratic integration of past and present in Italian culture. On the left is a self-portrait, another one, by De Chirico in Baroque costume from the late 40s. In the 40s and 50s, De Chirico painted a series of self-portraits that reference poses and backgrounds from Baroque paintings. There was an important retrospective of De Chirico in Milan in 1970 that included these little studied works and that Antani visited. On the right is pop artist from Rome, Tano Festa, with a 1964 work that quotes a detail from the creation of Adam in Michelangelo's Sistine Chapel. During an interview, Festa explained that for a Roman artist, the Sistine Chapel is more pop than the Coca-Cola bottle. In the early 60s, film director and writer Pierpaolo Pasolini restaged two famous depositions by Mannerist painters Pontormo and Rosso Fiorentino in Rome. In his short film La Ricotta, which was shot in the outskirts of Rome. On the left are two frames of these tableau vivants. The rest of the film, which is about a film director played by Orson Welles, who makes a film about the Passion of Christ, is in black and white. Similarly, Antani's photographs are color-tinted black and white prints and are images about other images. On the right are frames from a short film the Turin-based arte povera artist Michelangelo Pistoletto conceived in 1968 entitled Pistoletto and Sotheby, in which he, his wife and friends staged tableau vivants such as the late 19th century self-portrait with a flowered head by the Belgian James Enzor that in turn references a self-portrait by 17th century Flemish painter Peter Paul Rubens and to which 5 years later Enzor added a flowered head. We also see Maria Poppi, Pistoletto's wife, redoing the 1911 Nude Woman by German expressionist Ernst Ludwig Kirchner. Usually, Antani's poses are more freely inspired by specific paintings. These are two examples inspired by late 16th century Italian paintings. On the left is Giovane con frutta da pre Caravaggio, Young Man with Fruit after Caravaggio from 1977-78, which loosely references Caravaggio's famous Boy with Basket of Fruit. And on the right is Schiavo Liberiatico d'Apre Tintoretto from around 1976, which quotes the posture of a single figure in Tintoretto's tumultuous miracle of the slave, specifically the naked figure of the slave on the ground, swamped by the surrounding crowd. On the left is a work from the group of historical and imaginary Maharajas, entitled Shivaji from 1976-77. And on the right is a print of the kind the artist used as a model for his pose. Shivaji was a 17th century Indian king, ruler of Maharashtra, who fought against the Mughals at a time when they were dominating the Indian subcontinent. The print on the right is an oleograph from the Modern Litho Works Press in Mumbai, dated 1931. This was the time when images of Shivaji started to become popular as he became a hero for the Hindu nationalist movement. Later on, images of Shivaji entered massively into calendar art. This one by Antony is one of the most elaborately costumed and accurate impersonations. The quality of the hand coloring is rather high compared to other works. For this pose, he collaborated with a photographer from Madras named Krishnan, who involved a professional makeup artist working for the local film studios. By the way, Madras at the time was a capital of film production. In the other works from this group, Antony did not impersonate specific historical personages like Shivaji, but rather generic figures dressed in the attire of the Maharajas from Rajputana, now Rajasthan, as in the work on the left, dated 1977, which is in the Calabresi collection in Rome and bears the title of the series. This work was reproduced on the front of the invitation postcard for the exhibition at Latico in 1978. On the right is a colonial period postcard, possibly from the early 20th century, courtesy of the Alkazi Foundation in Delhi. Like Shivaji, this photograph was very finely tinted, but with the collaboration of Rajendra Studio in Jaipur. Rajput princes have in common with Shivaji a legendary loyalty to Hindu traditions. They opposed the Muslim invasion, and in colonial times, they resisted the Anglicization encouraged by the British. When Antony started his series, Indian princes had just been derecognized and dispossessed of their privileges by a parliamentary bill. Antony posed for this picture in the countryside just outside Jaipur. He was wearing clothes originally owned by a Maharaja of Jaipur and rented for the occasion. The contrast between the everyday cow and the elegantly dressed and posed figure is remarkable. And one could argue that the cow is what makes this landscape Indian rather than any landscape. Probably Antony found the cow there and decided to include it in the picture. Let's now look at the postcard. It depicts a Gujarati Hindu from the Gujarat state southwest of Rajasthan. The man's posture, as you can see, bears a striking resemblance to that of Antony. Notice in particular the position of the left arm and hand. Although it might not have been the specific model for Antony's work. Indian art historian and cultural anthropologist Jatindra Jain suggested that this is a highly cultivated and mannered posture, which is a sign of an aristocratic person keeping his body and clothes contained unto himself, in contrast to poor people, like farmers or laborers, who were photographed with both hands loosely hanging down and quite frightened in front of the camera. Jain also suggested that this posture might be the result of a stylization over time of aristocratic attributes, such as carrying a shawl over the bent arm, depicted in Mughal and Rajput portraits of noblemen. On the left is a work that more directly references painted portraits from the Mughal period. Here Antony poses like a Maharaja or high dignitary, but instead of holding a gem or flower, as in Mughal miniature paintings, he carries a little bowl of aluminum foil. This work is from 1978 and is entitled Full con pallina di carta stagnola, full with little bowl of aluminum foil, and here full stands, of course, for full-length portrait. In the middle and on the right are two early 17th century Mughal miniature paintings. On the right is Emperor Jahangir, holding the globe of temporal power, which comes from Christian iconography. One wonders if Antony's little bowl of aluminum foil is not a parody of the globe of power. From the third group of typical or common contemporary Indians, I'm showing you on the left Over the Moon from 1975. This is one of Antani's first works in the series. It was inspired by bizarre photos, in which the use of cheap cutout forms is common, and there are also photos that mimic Bollywood scenes in which actresses and actors pose on cutout moons during songs that interrupt the movies. To give you an idea of the kind of bizarre images that Antani could run into, on the right is a bizarre picture probably from the early 80s in the Satish Sharma collection, assembled from street studios and flea markets. Bizarre photography can be considered a form of escape, a way of imagining oneself as someone else that the lower classes can afford. From the same group are the triptych Indian Band at the bottom and Arte Mary Age on top, both from 1976-77. In Indian Band, Antani restaged one of the most bizarre phenomena of post-colonial India. The brass bands that still to date play at marriages in this faux military outfit derived from that of British military bands during colonial times. And of course, they play European instruments. Apparently, traditional Indian bands disappeared as a result of the death of the princely states with independence, as the patronage fell out. Notice the interjection of Antani's camp sensibility in the leg warmers and women's shoes. The pink, yellow, and blue of the backgrounds are colors commonly used by Antani as symbols of the feminine, the masculine, and the union of the two, or the androgynous. In the work on top, Antani plays the role of the typical Indian bridegroom in traditional costumes in front of the pink walls that encircle the old city of Jaipur. Antani impersonated three of the most popular gods in the Hindu pantheon: Shiva, Hanuman, and Krishna. In Shiva Shiva, right here, on the left, Antani posed as Shiva doing the blessing hand gesture. Blessing in Sanskrit is Ashirvad, hence the work's title, which contracts Shiva and Ashirvad. For this and his other impersonations of Hindu deities, Antani looked at popular images of deities that could be purchased at bazaars near temples, like the print from Brijbasi Press in Delhi on the right, which at the time was commercially available in different sizes from postcard to poster size. They are the equivalent of the Italian Santini, and their kitsch quality must have similarly caught Antani's interest. Cultural anthropologist Christopher Pini and art historian Kadri Jain, among others, have argued that these mass-produced images of deities constituted a site for cultural identity negotiation in colonial and post-colonial India. According to Jain, the realm of the bazaar is, quote, the space of a shared pan-national visual idiom, unquote, to which the famous Indian painter Raja Ravi Varma first contributed with the oleographs of his own paintings in the late 19th to early 20th century. Also, an aspect of Indian art and culture that must have captured Antani's interest is the notion of darshan, or seeing and being seen by a deity, which is a key notion in Hindu religious practice that is responsible for the enormous stress placed on visuality and the ubiquity of printed god pictures. Unlike Shiva Shiva, Hanuman exists in a few slightly different poses. In comparison to Shiva Shiva, Hanuman seems more humorous, perhaps because of Antani's efforts to appear like the monkey god with his fake tail and blown cheeks. Antani's personifications of Hanuman are reminiscent of one of the god's most popular depictions, which portrays him worshipping Lord Rama, his consort Sita, and his brother Lakshmana, as told in the epic of the Ramayana. In Hanuman, as in his other Hindu deity poses, Antani wore props that Indians use in devotional theatrical traditions that are still alive today. On top are photos of a store's storage in the Kinari Bazaar in Old Delhi, with Hanuman's clubs on the left and Shiva's trident on the right. Below is a backstage scene of a recent reenactment of the Ramayana called Ram Lila that lasts several days as part of a full festival called Dussehra. Speaking with art historian Kavita Singh from Nehru University in Delhi, she mentioned that in northern India, this festival used to be quite popular and every neighborhood used to have its own reenactment. So Antani engages in a double mimicking. He is mimicking an actor playing Hanuman. While Antani had both Shiva Shiva and Hanuman shot in photo studios, he stages Krishna's outdoors in significantly different settings and poses. However, he always impersonated Krishna as the flute player, possibly because this is a greatly popular subject in Indian visual culture. It is inspired by the story of Krishna playing the flute and enchanting the cowgirls with his music, narrated in the Bhagavad Puran. As in Shiva Shiva and Hanuman, in Krishna, Ontani adopted the main iconographic attributes of the god, like his bluish skin and flower garlands, although he did not include the usual peacock feather in the headgear. In the version on the right, Ontani holds the most common posture of Krishna, the flute player. He is standing with one leg bent over the other. The natural landscape in the background of this and Ontani's other Krishna poses is reminiscent of the pastoral setting common in bizarre images and poster art. As an example, on the left is a Brijbasi 1950s offset print from a painting by Narottam Sharma, a Natvara artist from around 1930. This is considered to be the best-selling image in the history of the printing industry. What is most interesting here is that postcards and prints coming from Europe, mostly Britain, France, Italy, and Germany, inspired Natvara artists to reformulate popular representation of deities, which in turn inspired Ontani to make his painted photographs. However, Ontani's reinterpretations strike as unideal from an Indian point of view due to their characteristic economy of means and sense of detachment. There is another devotional theatrical tradition called Ras Lila that involves Krishna as the flute player. However, only Brahmin boys rather than adults play the part of Krishna. On the right is a boy playing Krishna in a performance in Vrindavan in the mid-70s. These performances occur during festivals such as the one that celebrates the birth of Krishna and during which boys are dressed as Krishna, even independently of the reenactments. On the left are two early 20th century images from Brijbasi Press, possibly used as votive objects in domestic shrines. They are postcard-sized hand-painted bromide prints that also depict boys dressed as Krishna. These are two recent works by prominent artists active in India who share some of Ontani's concerns, although Ontani did not influence them directly. On the left is a sepia-toned hand-colored photograph that Udaipur-based American artist Wazwo X. Wazwo realized in collaboration with local artists. It is entitled Sauresh Playing Hanuman and is from 2007. This is partly a documentary photograph, as Sauresh plays Hanuman in real life, but not in the Ram Lila. He is a street kid who begs dressed as Hanuman, as this elevates his status in the eyes of the Indian people. On the right is Indian artist Pushpamala N, posing as the Hindu goddess Lakshmi after an early 20th century holograph by Raja Ravi Varma. This is a color photograph from 2001, part of the series Native Women of South India. I will now conclude with some remarks on the narcissistic subtext in Ontani's work in relation to the socio-political context of 1970s Italy. These are two 1977 works in En route vers l'Inde that lend themselves well to my conclusion. On the left is Ontani assuming the pose of the first painter of the Holy Virgin Mary, Saint Luke, inspired by a mid-17th century painting by Guercino. And on the right, he is assuming a primate-like crouch. In a recent study on the question of identification with place, architecture historian Neil Leach draws on Herbert Marcuse's sympathetic reinterpretation of narcissism as a mechanism for potential engagement with the other. Leach suggests the narcissistic identification can be either literal identification with the self, in which case it leads to reification of the self and is ultimately nihilistic, or it is identification with the non-identical, in which case it remains continuously open and leads to self-transcendence and metamorphosis. The kind of narcissistic identification Ontani enacts in his work seems a continuously open identification with the non-identical. It is a way of, quote, making one's limits explicit in order to discover other possibilities, unquote, as he explained in reference to his travels to India. Although Ontani's work is not overtly political, his decision to opt for an inquiry into identity as a construct, unstable or ambiguous, and into the filtered nature of culture and history by means of his own body, should be seen in relation to the post-1968 disillusionment and the struggle for power and control that political groups of the time were engaging in. Rather than giving up or getting involved in political power struggles, Ohntani embraced artistic strategies that could lead to transformation and liberation by making potentialities accessible. Thank you for your attention. Now we have time for a few questions. Yes, in the back, I think.
Hi, I just wanted to ask, do you know of any plans to exhibit these photographs?
If I know of?
Any plans to exhibit?
Oh, any plans to exhibit the photographs? No, I actually don't yet. Yeah. Yes?
Could you just say again the very last part? What was his reasoning for going to India? This is just the very last quote, was very interesting.
The reasoning for going to India?
Yes, how he phrased
it. Oh, the sentence, yes.
Yes.
Let me get it again. A way of making, the quote starts here, quote, making one's limits explicit in order to discover other possibilities. Sure. I can give you the exact, you know, reference for this quote, the book from which it comes from, if you're interested.
Just a little comment on your mentioning that the cow in the self-portrait in Jaipur may be serendipitous. I don't think it's serendipitous at all. In fact, you relate it to a political undertext that has to do with Hindu resistance to Muslim invasion and then to what was happening actually also in India at that time. And I think
he looked for it.
Is a very powerful representation of all of that. Of that Hindu,
it's a Vahana of Krishna.
It's a sacred cow. I mean,
yeah.
It's a
yeah.
major. So I don't think it's, you know, it's
thank
there
you.
For a purpose.
I will totally think through this. Yeah. Thank you for that. Yes.
Do you want to elaborate a little bit on what you said at the end about the narcissism, which is not about the self?
It is also about the self, but it's... So, I was inspired by this book that I found, written by Neil Leach, right? And so he reinterprets Herbert Marcuse's own take on narcissism. And he explains in a clear way to me... he proposes to see two narcissisms, basically, a good one and a bad one. Mm? So the bad one is the one that is literal. Mm? And instead, the other one is the open one. So it's the identification with the non-identical. So basically, it would be like, this is inspired by Marcuse's take on narcissism as... Seeing the other in oneself. Say it again.
In what context?
Oh, Eros and Civilization.
Well,
1955. I think that's
that
the.
Itself is interesting.
It is interesting, and it was actually. I think it was translated later into time. Now, I'm not saying that that Ohntani was influenced by Marcuse's take on narcissism, but I think it is a useful way of.
But you can look at Marcuse is all about the switch from the early 60s to the late 60s and all the hippie dome and all of that.
Absolutely. Right? It's a very, very important figure.
Source.
Yeah.
You can use him.
Yeah. Marcuse is very important. And in fact, the first critic to promote Ohntani, an artist charting with whom I studied, Renato Barilli, in the book, the 1974 book, the very important one, in which he discusses De Chirico, and he also discusses Marcuse in depth, because that is a very... he is a very important figure, absolutely.
If you talk about narcissism, I think you should also at some point talk of primary narcissism, because good narcissism is also...
That's Freud. Yeah, that's go back to Sigmund Freud, primary and secondary. Yeah.
I mean, it's not for this talk, yeah. But for something for development.
Well, of course, also there is Lacan, and but I think that the most useful one, I mean, of course, once I elaborate on this, in the context of my dissertation, I have to expand and, make a clearer map of narcissism. That's for sure. Thank you.
One more question. How did the Italians react to these? I mean, did critics say anything interesting?
That's a very good question, and I got it last time on Monday, and I even went back to my notes and to find something. Actually, I did not find anything from that time. So far, I've not been able to find a review of the show at Lattico. The gallery doesn't keep any press. I've looked as much as I could, spending days at the National Library, looking through daily newspapers. I couldn't find a thing. Now, I know, though, for a fact that, when they were exhibited in Venice, there were so much stuff that probably they just got a mention. So that wouldn't be very interesting. The thing I know is that these works stayed with Sargentini, the gallery that organized the show, the first show, forever until very recently. So certainly there wasn't the collectors were not very interested in this. And I understand it in relation to the difficulty to understand the subjects. For most people, the San Luca, sure, you understand. If you're Italian, you can relate to it. But this one, I'm not sure. I mean, I went and traveled and saw things and did the research, and this made so much more sense to me. So in general, though, Antani's works have never had a strong support in terms of collections, collectors. Well, there are some, of course, but actually more recent than older, right? Like Giulio di Gropello, and actually, yeah, showed you something from his collection, and Calabresi himself, because he was never part of any movement, he's not someone who promotes himself at all.
But Sargentini promotes his own.
Well, but he's not a real market person at all. I mean, I know he's done things that, very strange for a gallery. He's an artist, he's a theater person. Sargent, you know that, right? Yeah. Yes. Yes, he's still alive. He's actually traveling to London. Was that your question too? No, you know he's still alive. Let me just answer to that quickly. My colleague at CUNY. So he's still alive. He's traveling to London. He's actually going to do a tableau vivant procession now he's not posing himself. He's using these papier-mâché masks with the gallery, Serpentine Gallery in London, on the occasion of Frieze, the art fair. Rafaela.
I was just wondering if these exhibitions at Lattico were accompanied by critical text or...
Absolutely no.
Catalogs? No?
Absolutely nothing.
No.
And there isn't even a list, actually, of the works that were there. And that's, so I've, I did some research in the archive, which just recently was put together. And, the archive of the gallery. And so based on the memory of the artist, he has actually images of every single work in the show, but he can't find them. And I've been asking for these images for now 2 years. So eventually maybe he'll find them, even ask for images for this presentation. And he did a really good job. He sent a lot of them. He's very generous and nice and super sweet, but super organized.
Is this lack of critical text a choice of the artist?
Of critical text. For the gallery, for the show, or in general?
For the show.
Choice of the artist?
I mean,
both
of
them.
Ambiguity.
I mean, Antani is not looking for someone who writes on this series now, and I'm sure he wasn't looking for someone writing on the series then. They're both people who believe a lot in first-hand experience of the work and mediation, critical text. I'm not sure. No, I think they both agreed on not having anything. Probably also a budget reason, but they had a good poster size image of the the work with the cow. They had the postcard, but other than that, and they don't even have they haven't kept even a list of the works in the exhibition, which would be very important, right? Yes.
You traveled to India and met some of the artisans that you collected.
Yes, I met a couple.
Were there interesting responses to his work there?
If there was an interesting response to the work in India, this is not something I discussed with the people I met who worked with him. A couple things. The response to the work in India from the 1991 show was a bit of a scandal, because Because reinterpreting, like impersonating these deities for a Hindu is not so nice. I mean, it's a little bit, it's almost at the border of being, you know, a taboo thing. And so what he told me was that, so he decided to hang the works in a place. It was above the entrance arch. And at the opening, they decided to reroute the entrance of the exhibition so that the officials would not walk past those works. But something similar happened in Italy too because of nudity. I mean, Italy, for some people, you know, more conservative people, these works can be, taken as offensive. Some of these works, you know, take the San Sebastian, for instance, you know, like a naked man, like almost naked man doing the San Sebastian in that very sensual way. And so it happened something similar in Italy. The officials were like the mayor of the city where the show took place was, you know, they made the mayor skip the gallery with his works. Although it was part of the display, so just didn't get proceed, and he saw that. So this is a very recent instance. In terms of the people who collaborated with him, I was really surprised to find that one of them, Rajendra, who's the one who really worked with him a lot, didn't speak a word in English, and so I had to find a translator. And this place is like it's one door. In this little street with the writing in Hindi, it's like, it's a very interesting reality, very, very local. And I guess, and I asked him, how did you communicate with these people? Because he doesn't speak English very well, Antoni, he doesn't mind saying that. And these other people, and he doesn't speak Hindi for sure. And so he said, hand gesture. Like, okay. So you understand that a lot must have been like happening by chance, right?
Which has to be Italian.
Exactly. Italians and Indians are very similar. You know, you talk a
hand gestures, like, yeah. Yes.
And the images of San Sebastiano was from when? Early 70s? Like 60s?
Okay, so the chronology of Antoni's work and life is problematic. So because he, like you see, there is like a short circuit, temporal short circuits in his work. He doesn't care he's never been interested in establishing or correcting his chronology. So you find a lot of contradictions in the literature. And he himself dates works differently, remember things differently. So according to my own research, he said that the person who took this picture is this person. And I don't remember. No, it's not Cesare Bastelli, someone else. According to, you know, the photographer and other details, like an investigator, I think this is early 70s. It could be 70, 71, not 72. 70, 71. But 70, I'm not super sure.
Yeah.
Think more 71.
Was it expressed in any way by critics or the public interpreted of the homoeroticism in any way at that time, or was it later?
Oh, that's another good question. Okay, so the first critical text was by Barilli in 1970. It was not about these works. These works were first shown, I think, in 1974. I still have a question mark on a show, an international exhibition in Yugoslavia, but I've been waiting forever to get a response from the people who organized the show, Biljana Tomic, the international festival in Belgrade, but because there's no catalog. Maybe they were exhibited in 73 the first time, but certainly in 74. After that...
I believe that 74 show in Yugoslavia was a performance more than...
Oh, you were there?
Well, no, he was talking to me about
it. Oh.
And Marina Abramović being there.
Marina Abramović, but there were two. There was one in 73 and one in 74, right?
He made a major performance there. You could talk to him about that.
I could talk to?
As opposed to showing...
Yes.
Of course, it's interesting, this whole thing about Yugoslavia, because it's this very strong thing about performance, and so there's another side of him that would go perfectly well there, right?
Mm-hmm.
Performance, the body.
Well, these are all, in fact, you know, I would call him more a performance artist than a photographer, because these are performative photographs. I mean, he's performing as, I mean, they're both, right? But, yeah.
His reinterpreting of doing the Renaissance paintings, mannerism, was there anybody else doing this at any time?
Well, as I showed in the little detour, right?
Yeah.
But I have to tell you something else. But I haven't included everything. But there were other people right around 1970 who were redoing painting, figures from paintings like Salvo, Salvatore Mangione, right? But he did one after a self-portrait by Raffaello as a photograph. And then he went on to painting actually really soon, much, you know, way earlier than the Transavanguardia artists. 73, 74 he started doing this. Vettore Pisani was not redoing specific works, it was more like inspired by, right?
But it's a kind of...
Yeah, it is part of the same, yes. But Salvo was very literal in this one photograph that he got, like self-portrait, photographic self-portrait, that was after a self-portrait by Raffaello, which is beautiful. It's a beautiful picture, actually. It was on view in Venice as part of the show, the Italian art show, the big one that... Italics, yeah.
His choice of color and the way he muted the colors is fascinating, actually, the way to get that image to work.
You mean the tinting, the hand tinting? Oh, it is. And if you look at these works in reality, they are incredible. I mean, the quality of some of them really blows you away. But the Indians have this tradition, and they, you know, I met one of the few surviving hand tinting, you know, hand colorists. It's called Sri Indra Prakash. I met him and I interviewed him. This is like a retired, really nice man in his like late 70s, early 80s. And he showed me some of his work, and you can't even tell it's been hand-tinted. It almost looks like it was just printed in color. So it's amazing. But it does give it like a sweeter, like a softer...
Yeah, especially the ones of Christ coming down from the cross. And they were aged each... person in that.
You mean the tableau vivant, but those were not, those were color frames from a color movie, like the color, only in color.
Yeah.
That was not on tanning.
Yeah.
They were not hand tinted.
Oh, okay.
That was like a color film.
And
but they were the only scenes in color, we have to go, I see, no? The only scenes in color of the entire film that was in black and white, and so the parallel, it just struck me, the parallel.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, well, I think we can stay for maybe one more question, and I'm happy to continue the conversation with whoever is interested. So, did you want to ask the one?
To get the pieces for the Indian costumes, and those were all done in India, or did he have...
Oh, no.
In Italy?
It was done in India, and I asked him, of course. I was very interested. And he says he doesn't remember very well, but he thinks that, because of the language thing, right? He thinks that Sargentini helped with that. On the occasion of the 1977 traveling exhibition, there was actually a cultural association based in Madras with which they worked, and probably they were bilingual, and Sargentini for sure speaks English well, or does speak English in some, you know, gets along. And so they had, you know, they... And maybe it was done around that time. You know, 77, 78 was more the time when he did all these Maharajas portraits as a Maharajas. Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you all.